Let's get us started for this hour with Dr. Brian Cox, Wonders of the Universe, the book and the TV series. It's on the Sci-Fi Channel, on the Science Channel right now, and taking your calls to this hour. Then we'll move to open lines coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, getting to some calls here coming up in just a minute with Dr. Brian Cox. Let me ask you about Neil deGrasse Tyson. Are you friendly with him here at?
Yes, I'm not. I know him. I've not met him very. I think I've met him once or something. But I do speak to him on Twitter occasionally.
Yeah. I think you guys would get along famously.
Yeah. And he's doing. They've just been announced, isn't it? That they're doing a kind of a remake. I don't know if it's a remake, of Cosmos, the great Carl Sagan series from 1979, with Anne Druyan, who I do know, who's Carl Sagan's widow. So that's really exciting. Actually, I think it's not going to be ready till 2013 or something. But that's great. I mean, that's mainstream, getting real astronomy and science on mainstream TV again. I think it's Fox that are doing it. That's brilliant. Really excited about that.
Yep. And we started the conversation last hour talking about the briny flows of water on Mars whether or not they are happening. What do you think the likelihood is that there are flows of water, seasonal flows of water then on Mars?
Yeah, well, that's what the photographs certainly look like. That I mean, it's photographic evidence from I think it's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the spacecraft in orbit around Mars, and you know, there's been evidence for a while. We know there was water there, and there's been mounting evidence that there's water subsurface on Mars, and this is another piece of evidence. So there's been a lot of it now. So I think that it is a smoking gun now. And what we have to do, of course, now is get there and look, because the discovery of life on another world will be one of the great discoveries in the history of humanity. And you've got to remember, these things are not expensive. You know, I mean, this is one of the great frustrations, I think, for me, is that this is one of the questions, one of the great questions that we can answer. Are we alone in the universe? We've got some evidence now that we can begin to go and answer that question. Why wouldn't we do it? You know, you're talking about single-figure billions here. You're not talking about, you know, 10% of GDP or anything like that. You're talking about the amount of money that what was it, 100 trillion was wiped off the value of the stock market this week or something like that?
Right.
So, I mean, for that, you could actually go to Mars physically, wander around, drive around on it, and probably build a city. Mm-hmm. You know, for the amount of money that we lost, ethereal money that evaporated away on the stock market this week.
Let's get to a couple of calls. Let's go to Rick, who's in Phoenix, Arizona, on Coast to Coast AM, west of the Rockies, for Dr. Brian Cox. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, Brian. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I had a question pertaining to if you've had any research in the moon's gravitational pull and its effect on the body's mood, since the body is mostly comprised of water. I've picked up that bit of information on a while ago, and I was curious if you had any more information on it.
There's virtually no effect at all. The water's a kind of a, in Britain we'd say it was a red herring. I don't know if you have that saying in the States. So the tides are raised by what's called the differential gravitational effect. So it's the fact that the moon pulls, because one side of the Earth is closer to the moon than the other side, obviously, because the moon's, you know, in one place. So the Earth gets, and the water on it gets kind of stretched out into a football shape, you know, it's a kind of an oval shape. And then the Earth rotates beneath the water, and that's why you get tides. So it's not that water is anything special in this. It's not the gravitational pull on the water is the same as everything else, but it's because water's more flexible than rock, then you get this slight bulge of water facing the moon. And in fact, you get, because of the way this works, you get a bulge on the other side as well, which is why you get two high tides in every 24 hours. So it's nothing to do with water at all. So that's just kind of a red herring.
We'll have a wild card line open if somebody wants to grab that. Bill is in West Hartford, Connecticut, east of the Rockies, for Dr. Brian Cox, Wonders of the Universe. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, hi, Ian. Hi, Brian. Brian, I'm an amateur astronomer, so I understand completely what you're talking about. I have two great questions for you about life in our solar system outside of the Earth. The first one relates to the Mars Science Laboratory. NASA will launch in November. I'm comparing that to ExoMars, Europe's ExoMars. And the second question involves Europa, the moon of Jupiter that you mentioned, and Enceladus, the moon of Saturn. Question number one, why can't MSL, Mars Science Laboratory, why didn't they, in other words, when they built MSL, put in the kind of actual light detection instruments that ExoMars will have when it's launched about 2018, instead of just looking to see if Mars is potentially potentially habitable without actually looking for life? And question number two, considering the fact that meteorites have come from Mars and hit the Earth, so the Earth could have been seeded with life from Mars, meaning that life could have started on one planet, Mars, and transferred to the Earth, wouldn't it be obviously more beneficial to have NASA, as soon as possible, have a highly sophisticated spacecraft, one to go to Europa and drill under the ice of Europa, as well as to go to Enceladus and do the same thing, because they're so far away, 500 million miles and a billion miles away, there's far less chance of Europa or Enceladus contaminating the Earth with their life?
Yeah, they're two brilliant questions. I mean, ExoMars, actually, I should say that I was, years ago now, I was on a review panel for that and for the thing called the Life Marker Chip, which is what you're talking about. So for everyone who's listening, the ExoMars project, which I think is going to be a joint NASA European Space Agency project now, is the idea to put a big lander onto the surface with dedicated instruments to look for organic molecules and to really go down and try and look for signs of life, whereas the NASA mission that's about to launch is not that. It's looking for the geological kind of basis, you know, to look at the geology. I don't know is the answer. I don't know why. It must be to do with budgets and to do with just bits of politics and what you can get funded, because obviously, to me, it's obvious that what you want to do is get there and with experiments that, like the Viking missions in the 70s, that are dedicated experiments to go and look for life. So I don't really understand why you wouldn't do it. There must be some reason why you'd do a cheaper version to go and search for landing sites, maybe, and then send a big one to, because it would be, that's probably the reason, actually, because it would be ridiculous if you built this beautiful life science laboratory, which cost trillions, hundreds of billions, trillions of them, maybe, and then landed it in the wrong place. So maybe it's entirely sensible to go and try and scout out the landing sites for these things before you send them there. So maybe that's the reason. And the second question, it's a really good question. We mentioned Europa, you know, this moon of Jupiter that has this huge ocean below its surface. And people have said for many years, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to drill through the ice, which, as I mentioned, maybe 60 miles deep. So you're talking about a lot of ice. And the problem there is, how do you drill? I mean, what do you do? I mean, these, you know, how do you get the power up there? You'd probably, as I said before, need to do some kind of quite large nuclear-powered sort of power source on the thing. And there are just political problems with that. It's just getting nuclear power into space is difficult. So that's probably, that's the sticking point with Europa, is how to get through the ice. Also, I should say at the end, the caller mentioned Enceladus, which is a fascinating little moon of Saturn, which very recently, just a few years ago, Cassini observed fountains of ice. So fountains of water ice rising up from the surface of this little moon, which is about as big as the United Kingdom. So it's a tiny little moon orbiting around Saturn. But it's suggestive that there are pockets of water beneath the surface, because there are plumes of water ice flying up from the surface, which actually make one of Saturn's rings. So it's a beautiful place. And again, that's somewhere we should go. We need to go there and land on it.
You mentioned the political issues around using nuclear power as a propellant to space, but you're a physicist. What are the scientific problems of that? And could we, I mean, do we have the technology that guarantees that there wouldn't be a problem? And what's the worst case scenario for putting nuclear power in space?
We have the technology to do it. The big problem is if you blow it up on launch. I mean, if you have a very, very big thing with a lot of nuclear material on it and you blow it up, you know, 10 seconds after launch, which happens, then you've got a problem. So it's, but you don't have problems with very small amounts of radioactive material, because they just get dispersed and there's not an issue with it. And it should be said that the Apollo spacecraft were nuclear powered, and the Apollo 13 lunar module is now at the bottom of the ocean because it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, which it wasn't meant to do. But as you remember with Apollo 13, the whole spacecraft had to come back again. And so that's called a radioisotope thermal generator, but there's quite a lot of material in there. But they're designed to survive re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. They were designed to survive a catastrophic failure of the launch vehicle, and it did. And there's no evidence of leaking from it. So basically, I suppose what you'd have to do is launch it in bits with relatively small amounts of nuclear material and then assemble it on the space station or something like that. I suppose that's the way you'd want to do it. Probably launch in an entirely intact submarine nuclear reactor. The only problem would be making it safe if you had to, you know, the rocket blew up basically on launch. You know, you don't want to...
Right.
So I suppose that's the issue. But there's not, I mean, we've lost, it should be said all deep space probes are nuclear powered. So Voyager, Cassini, Galileo, all those things that go to the outer planets are nuclear powered because they have to be, because there's nothing else you can do. But they're very small amounts of nuclear material. And therefore, if there was a problem, then it doesn't matter. So that's the challenge, really.
First time caller line, Mark is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on Coast to Coast for Dr. Brian Cox. Mark?
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Mark.
I'm currently a college student in Oklahoma for mechanical engineering. I'm looking for some advice. I was wondering, in your opinion, what kind of industry-specific field would be the most productive career path I could pursue for the sake of science and mankind?
I mean, I think that just you're doing it already. I mean, in Britain and the US, there's a huge shortage of engineers. We know that. There are amazing numbers. I know the numbers for the UK, and it's literally hundreds of thousands of engineers that we need that we haven't got. And it's the same in the US. I mean, engineering is in my view, science and engineering are the future of mankind. So it's virtually anything that you do. If you're looking for kind of my wish is that scientists and engineers, as well as being professional scientists and engineers, go and spread the word for rational thought, really, as well. So that's one, I think, the great services that we can do as well as in our professional life. It's really important. And that's not to be... Sometimes you get confused. You know, people think that science is kind of rather dry, and it's rather, you know, we've talked about, you know, we brushed up against this fact. Does it remove a bit of magic? You know, is there no room for things like astrology? Well, it doesn't do that at all. I mean, the thing is that all the things we're talking about, you know, searching for life on Mars with these missions, these great questions, they're all going to be answered. They were all, you know, the evidence has been uncovered by this process of great scientists and great engineers trying to explore the universe with a completely open mind. So I think it's that message. It's that there's nothing threatening. I mean, you said that tomorrow, I think you're talking about, will our domestic appliances take over the world or something like that? Like we're going to get attacked by a coffee machine or something.
And there's an idea of what's the technology in RFID chips and what are some of the other things which can, for our own personal security, how much are we investing in technology to save us when really what we're doing is we're empowering technology in a way to betray us on a scale that we can't even quite imagine yet. And we sort of accept that technology, something technological, we can trust it when sometimes, you know, we can look at some of the car theft rates, for example, and we see how easy it is to defeat this technology, which we otherwise invest in. And not only can it be easily defeated, it can be defeated in mass. And so now you're not just losing your car, you could be losing tons of cars faster than you ever have before. That's when technology can betray us.
Yeah, so it's the deployment of technology. I mean, so it's always worth saying that that if you were to remove our technological capabilities, then you see, what's the life expectancy before we had the modern scientific age? I mean, it's probably about 25 years old, maybe 20, you know. So actually, you know, the overwhelming impact of science and technology has been entirely positive. So I suppose you're right. It's politics, really, I suppose, isn't it? It's the technology is what it is. I suppose it comes down to regulation about how you use it. But what I'm worried about, the wider context, is a Frankenstein-type paranoia I mean, it's interesting actually to look back in history to the point when Mary Shelley's Frankenstein was indeed a novel that changed. It was part of a change in our relationship with science, which had been entirely positive up to that point. I mean, science was the driving force that was going to change civilization, and indeed it was. This is the 19th century, and so that kind of slight paranoia about scientific advance, about knowledge, is something that I think is entirely destructive. But it's obviously innate in the human makeup because it's been there for many centuries.
I think there are times when, and I'm going to guess and say we disagree on this, but I think there have been times when science has demonstrated that its adherence to the scientific method, which, while very valuable, is not infallible. And so what we have oftentimes from people who use the word rationalist and say that if we think it, then it's rational. And then the leap from that is often a matter of, even when we're wrong, we're right because we use the scientific method. And so there are things we look at and we go, well, there was a consensus of science about all sorts of things. And the consensus of science is not always right. So sometimes the dissenting view is right, and sometimes the consensus view is right.
Let me just say, it's never right. The key thing about the scientific method is that everything is open to be shown to be wrong. Falsifiability is the key foundation of a scientific theory. If you have a theory that's not falsifiable, then it's not science, in my opinion. Well, not actually my opinion, it isn't science, right? So that's the cornerstone of scientific progress, that everything you say has got to be falsifiable. So I agree with you, it's a misrepresentation of science to say that it's right. In fact, every theory, I can't think of a scientific theory that is not approximate now. So our best theory of gravity is Einstein's theory of general relativity. It was written down in 1915. It's passed every test. But it is certainly not the last word in understanding gravity. Our best theory of the other three forces of nature, called quantum field theories, these are the things that we explore at CERN in Geneva, for example, they're certainly not the last word in understanding the micro world. So it's entirely wrong to claim that any scientific theory is right. There's no such thing. What it is a description, a model of nature, if you like, a description of the evidence that we've got that works. And what we're doing that is trying to break them all the time. That's what CERN is. That's what the exploration is. It's trying to break the worldview.
I accept that completely. I think it's very interesting. But there are also times when consensus can be a cudgel. And so, at least from where I sit, I'm more of a student of history than a student of science, quite obviously. But I think that there are lots of advances that we've made which had been at one time considered to be impossible. Well, you know, some of that just comes down to rethinking what is possible. And that sometimes means that it may not even seem rational to think that certain things are possible that end up being true. But that'll have to hold. I'm sure you could take that apart like a train into a Twinkie. But let's hang on for a second and we'll get to a couple other thoughts on this. Other people want to jump in on Wonders of the Universe. Dr. Brian Cox, will take your calls till the top of the hour. And then for the rest of the show, we'll do open lines on the way on Coast to Coast. There is also an interesting story, many of them, at coasttocoastam.com. If you haven't looked at the news headlines yet, go there and find out more about this new type of flying vehicle that's in development. And up to 70% of British men are related to King Tut. We'll get to that coming up, too. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. All right, we have a first-time caller line. That's it. Other than that, just going to have to wait your turn for Dr. Brian Cox. We'll get in as many calls as we can before the top of the hour. Wonders of the Universe is the Science Channel series. It's originally a BBC series. He's working on another one that'll replace that one sometime in the future. It's easy to invest in this book, too. Wonders of the Universe. You'll find a perfect coffee table book. Lots of illustrations. Really brings it home. Good gift book, too. And we'll get to your questions and comments coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponnett. Well, I want to give you a chance to respond. I know we went to the bottom of the hour break there, and we're kind of rushed. And so do you have a quick follow-up thought, or do you just want to jump back into the calls?
No, it's fine. We'll go to the – I'm trying to remember what you finished on now.
Ah, see, there you go. That's how
– You said something controversial over the music, so that
– Was it controversial? Well, you tell me. I don't think the idea of saying that that the consensus of science is sometimes used as a cudgel. I don't consider that to be controversial.
Yeah, no, I think this – I mean, in a sense, I mean, it is true, I suppose, that science – well, the process is very clear, which is, as I have outlined before, that the point of science is to break down theoretical views, right? That's how you progress. So I suppose there's always in a group of people, then I suppose there's always, it can be difficult to, I don't know, in my experience in doing research, then if your evidence that you have, if you present it properly, and even if it runs against a very widely held paradigm, then it's considered properly. And if there are no errors in your methodology, then there it is. It gets published, it goes through the peer review process. And I'm not, whilst it's easy to conceive of, it's a very easy idea to have this big establishment that tries to stifle things, you know, because that's what tends to happen in the political arena. I've not seen it, you know. I think, in general, if you can demonstrate your methodology is sound and you really come up with something that runs against the mainstream view, then I think I don't think there's an issue. I've never seen it. I've never seen a problem.
Well,
the scientists I know think like that. That's the way that science is.
I guess you'll see a lot of meteorologists who disagree with the perceptions of climate change that's going on right now, that feel like they're looking at, there's not enough data in yet to make the assumptions that are being made, I'm not saying which my opinion is on that or one way or another, or even for that matter, how many planets are there in our solar system? I mean, are there 8? Are there 9? Are there 10? Where do we stand right now?
These are very different. I mean, that's a matter of definition, how many planets are there in the solar system. That's just there are a lot of objects. It depends what you call a planet, semantics. But climate change is interesting because it's very difficult, right? So modeling climate is difficult. And the data is good now. So my view of this is that it's become a toxic political issue, and it shouldn't be. What science can do, you can ask, given the best knowledge that we have, given the best data that we have and the best ways of modeling that we have, what is the likely outcome 100 years in the future, 50 years in the future, and you get a big spread of predictions. They tend to all be warming. They tend to all be, well, between, 1 and 4 degrees or something like that. But there it is. But that's the science. That's all you can do. And it is very complicated, which is why there's a big spread of predictions. Most of them, though, it should be said, if not all of them, are on the warming side. Then you start asking questions such as, well, what should you do about it? Now, that's politics, right? So it's a legitimate political position to say, I don't think we should do anything. I think the market will sort this out. Insurance premiums will go up. Maybe New York will get flooded and we'll all move to Colorado and the real estate will be expensive there. That's political, right? So it's become politicized in a very unfortunate way, I think. Some of the fault lies with scientists, because it's very easy to become an advocate. Because if you're a scientist, actually, one of my ex-PhD students who did particle physics is now a climate modeller. Most, if not all, of the people who work on the big computer science models of the climate see a warming trend in the data, and also see that the predictions predict that there's going to be potentially catastrophic problems in 50 to 100 years. And so they become advocates. And that's where the problem is, really. I think that in a very pure world, and we don't live in a pure world, but in the ideal world, you would say to scientists, what's your best model? And they'd say, well, here it is. That's the best we can do. And then society and politicians would say, well, okay, given that, then what should we do about it? But that's obviously not the way that it works. I think it's a very destructive debate, actually, because I think it's begun to – what you've got is politicians, political movements casting aspersions and trying to denigrate the science, which is not a sensible thing to do, because science is, at its best, is apolitical and is just the best you can do at the time. So I think that's where the danger is. It goes back to the kind of Frankenstein-type issues that we mentioned earlier on. You can't do much better. You can't do any better than the science. No claim to be right. It's just the best we can do at the time. And so I think I don't like the climate change debate. It's extremely toxic because it opens the door for people to attack the science itself, which is, you know, you shouldn't be. If there are problems, if you can point to because it's complex, there are areas which are not as well understood as other areas. So if you can go and point to it and say, well, here's my computer model, and here it is, and it stands up to scrutiny, and it predicts something else, then that's fine, and that will be brought into the debate, and people will be happy with it. So I think it's way over politicized.
Well, I want to get back to the calls, but I think there's a lot to be said for how people are treated if they bring that dissenting view. And that is part of our culture now, is that you would be branded a kook. You would be called not rational, the way that the word rational is thrown around. And I think that there's some threats of the politics of invalidation. In a perfect world, I think that's exactly how it would work. And I wish that were always the case. Let's get west of the Rockies. Matt is in Idaho Falls on Coast to Coast for Dr. Brian Cox, Wonders of the Universe. Matt?
Oh, good evening. I really enjoy your show. First off, I just want to say that.
Thank you,
Cox. I just watched the Arrow of Time episode just the other day. And kind of reminded me of Dr. Sagan, you know, Carl Sagan.
Thank you very much.
My question is I live about 90 minutes from Yellowstone National Park and the super volcano and all that. And I was just wondering how, you know, getting down to Earth here, how those things kind of factor into mass extinctions versus asteroids and things like that. And I also got to say, I just got to add this in parenthetically. Your pronunciation of the word geyser and geezer cracked.
Yeah, no, you're right.
It's because you feel like a geezer, Matt, when he says that. So, go ahead.
it's been said many times, actually. I do veer between these two pronunciations. Sorry about that. Super volcanoes. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think there's very strong evidence in the past they've been involved in mass extinctions. I filmed at a place in India, which is called the Deccan Traps, which is huge outflows of lava over a very short period of time, which certainly dramatically altered the Earth's climate. And also, I think there's very good evidence of a big supervolcano eruption in Indonesia a long time ago, which almost wiped out the human race. Right. So these things, and they've not gone away. The Earth is no less geologically active now than it was a billion years ago, really. So these things are big threats, and there's nothing you can do about them. So I don't want to scare people because they're quite rare. But you're right. The super volcanoes that we have today, they're monitored. The U.S. Geological Survey monitors that one. That your caller just mentioned, and they, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. If they explode, they change the atmosphere.
Let's go to Julia in Nashville, Tennessee, on Coast to Coast for Brian Cox. Julia?
Hi, good evening. Thank you very much for this opportunity, Professor Cox. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Okay, so I'm curious about our perception of time and potentially studying the mechanisms of time perception in the brain. And I watched your documentary about gravity, and it was very focused on the objective, if you will, or measurable aspects of time. But I've noticed in the field of neuroscience, where we study the human brain the human mind by examining how the brain works, there is very little known about time perception, but that seems to be a very important for two big domains of cognition, language and learning, in terms of basic functions but also more complex functions. So I'm just curious about your take on whether there is a good theoretical framework from physics now that could be used to kind of to motivate investigations in neuroscience for us to study how temporal perception might be influenced in different higher levels.
It's a great question, that actually. And I don't think, the first thing to say is in physics, we don't have a complete understanding of what time is at all. We have various different theories of it. There's Einstein's picture, which is that it's a dimension like space with some subtleties that prevent you from going backwards in it. So you don't have freedom of movement, but it's there and it gets mixed up. So depending on how you move around, then the time and space get mixed up together. So there's that bit. Then there's the bit that we dealt with in the last Wonders of the Universe show that was on this week, which is the so-called thermodynamic arrow of time, which is that things tend to get more disordered just for statistical reasons. The universe tends from order to disorder. And that's one of the key sort of foundations, I think, in physics of what it means, what the difference is between the past and the future. That the future is more disordered than the past. But I mean, the caller's absolutely right. The perception of time, I don't know much about that, the area of study, but I know that it's not well understood. There's one really interesting thing I'd like to mention, actually, which shows how counterintuitive the perception of time can be. But there's some crazy theories, but really good fun theories. There's a brilliant book called The Anthropic Cosmological Principle by John Barrow and Frank Tipler, which is a book that's been around for ages, and it's quite a technical book, but it's fantastic. It was written in the 80s, and it really gets speculative at the end. And it talks about what would happen in a universe that recollapses. Now, we think the universe is going to carry on expanding forever at the moment, but in the 80s, it was certainly that you could imagine that the universe might have so much matter in it that it would slow down in its expansion and then recollapse again. And they showed that there are these kind of weird theories called omega point theories, where in a recollapsing universe, the way that you can process information, if you were around at that time, a really advanced civilization, kind of your information processing capacity diverges faster than the universe shrinks back to a big crunch. And it's true that, so if you can process an infinite amount of information, then you're essentially immortal, because you can think everything that is possible to think in a very small bit of time. So I know there's a lot of work done on our perception of time, and essentially one of the theories, I think, is that it's to do with information processing rate. So you could define your life, your 80 years on this planet, as being this is the amount of information I managed to process in my brain. So you can imagine that if you can get a bigger brain, or you can go and, you know, transfer yourself into a computer or something like that, then you can process a lot more information, and so you can perceive yourself to live a lot longer. So I suppose it's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, that is interesting. I like that. Let me get to Frank in Corpus Christi, Texas, on a wild card line for Dr. Brian Cox. Frank?
Yeah, thank you, Ian. You got another wonderful show going. It's an honor to talk to you, Dr. Cox. I've got a two-part question. The first one is, what are your observations about the unknown dark matter and dark energy? And the second part of it is there a possibility that, you know, they talk about in string theory and stuff, the existence of alternate universes. Is it possible that these other universes that we can't tune into, that we can't perceive, are they somehow affecting that total energy and total mass?
It's a brilliant question. So we were talking earlier about, you know, paradigm shifts in science. It is true that now, as the caller said, we something like 96% of the universe, of the energy in the universe, is in a form that we don't understand, right? So the stuff that we understand with our so-called theories of everything that we have at the moment, right, 4% or so of the universe, that's the matter that we are made of. There's about something like 25% of the universe appears to be in some other form of matter, which is called dark matter, which is almost—it's probably some kind of subatomic particle that we've not yet discovered. And we have very good evidence. That's very mainstream now. It seems to be around. You see it in the way galaxies rotate, the way galaxies interact with each other. And then about 70% of the energy appears to be involved in accelerating the expansion of the universe. So the universe is accelerating its expansion, and that's pretty well established now. Great mystery. And that's what we call dark energy. And we have very much less of an idea of what that is, or understanding of that, than we do of the dark matter, which we're looking for now. So it's a great shift in our understanding of the universe. And we don't know what they are. But as your caller said, there are also theories that try to explain things like the weakness of gravity. Gravity is an incredibly weak force compared to the other three forces of nature. And they tend to end up with extra dimensions in the universe, as string theory does as well. So it's impossible to imagine, but you could almost imagine us on a sheet, floating around on a sheet, a two-dimensional sheet. And if everything you can perceive is on that sheet, imagine a sheet of paper in the room in front of you now. Imagine that light's trapped on the sheet. Imagine that the forces of nature can only travel on the sheet. Then you would not perceive anything off that sheet. You can't see anything because light doesn't get off the sheet, right? So this is one of the pictures of the way the universe could be. So we're floating around on this little sheet in a much bigger, higher dimensional universe, which is the room in front of you. And then those theories can, as far as I'm aware, can perhaps manifest themselves as these strange things, dark energy particularly. So why is the universe stretching? Well, maybe it's something to do with the fact there are extra dimensions. It's all very, very speculative, but the caller's right. I mean, people think about this. It's a great time in cosmology at the moment and particle physics, because those two things, the study of the large-scale universe and the study of the very small subatomic universe, they're coming together in these areas, like what is this dark matter stuff? And we're really, I think, on the verge of a paradigm shift in our understanding of the universe. There's definitely something that we don't understand going on at a very fundamental level that is affecting the large-scale evolution of the universe and also the way the universe behaves at a subatomic level.
It's genuinely fascinating. In the time we have left, Alex is in Toronto, Canada, on Coast to Coast. So, Alex, I'll just ask you if you can to keep your question absolutely short so we can get your answer in there.
Go
ahead.
About Europa, how would you power a spacecraft to get through the miles of ice? I saw this thing on TV where the probe would be heated by, again, nuclear power, I know, but it would be hot and heavy, so it would just sink with its own weight and heat through the ice.
That's exactly right. So yeah, the idea, probably the only idea of getting through that 60 miles of ice or something, is to have a very hot tip on the probe. You would drop this probe onto the ice, and it would just melt its way through, and the ice would freeze behind it. Actually, one of the great challenges of Europa is to make sure you don't contaminate it. So there's an analog for this in the Antarctic at the moment. There's a lake called Lake Vostok, which is a huge sub-ice lake in Antarctica. It's under the Russian base, the Russian Vostok base. And that, we've drilled very close to that lake. It's been sealed for probably hundreds of thousands of years. So there could be life forms in there, you know, again, probably microbes and things, that are completely unknown to science. The question is, what do you do? You know, you don't want to drop something in there which is contaminated with loads of life from Earth and mess up the ecosystem if there's an ecosystem there. So that's one of the great challenges of exploring these things, like Mars as well. You don't want to introduce Earth-based organisms into that thing because you pollute it, you mess it up, you can't study it properly, you even perhaps destroy the life that's there.
Yeah, suddenly you'd be running into a competition, like Cro-Magnon versus Neanderthal or Homo sapien or something. We'll leave the rest up for the TV. I look forward to tracking you on your radio shows as well. Wonders of the Universe, Brian Cox, the book and the TV series on the Science Channel. Thank you for taking so many calls and for being so very interesting. And we look forward to having you back on again sometime. Did it go? Dr. Brian Cox, thank you so much. And coming up, then, we'll get into open lines on the way next. Sorry if we stranded a few people that were calling for Brian, but we got in as many as we could of the callers who were hanging on the longest. The rest is just going to be open lines. It's all up to you next on Coast to Coast. In for George, this is Ian Punnett.